Day Player on 720 WGN. First L in Chicago was put into service on June 6, 1892, when a steam locomotive pulling four wooden coaches carrying over a couple dozen people departed the 39th Street Station and arrived at the Congress Street Terminal 14 minutes later. And the CTA this year is even planning a special celebration to mark the 125th anniversary of the L in Chicago this June. Now, joining me tonight are two people that truly understand and appreciate the importance of our transportation systems in the city. And no one knows more about Chicago than WTTW's Jeffrey Bear, who in one of his dozens of broadcasted tours of Chicago has included the wonders of Chicago's elevated trains via the Loop, Bronzeville, Old Town, Wrigleyville, Garfield Park, among others. And historian and the CTA's Graham Garfield, who has spent most of his life in transportation and urban development, planning, design, and history. He's the general manager of customer information at the CTA and is also the proprietor of an amazing website. And I'm telling you folks, you got to check this out, called chicago-l.org. And both Jeffrey and Graham join us tonight. Good evening to you both.
Good evening.
Good evening.
So this is pretty exciting and pretty amazing that the L system has been around for 125 years.
Yeah, it's really become an indelible part of the character of Chicago, and still continues to serve its original purpose and do it very well, transporting hundreds of thousands of people every day.
Now, this has been, before the 125th anniversary, this has been tried out before. New York was the first that did an elevated train system, I believe. We tried it a couple times, but it wasn't until the Chicago and Southside Rapid Transit Railroad, they were the first ones to really be successful at this and actually make something happen, correct?
Yeah, there were other companies that were chartered and other plans that came before the Southside Elevated, but never really came to fruition, never got anything built. So the Southside Elevated was the first one to be able to make it happen.
Well, what people don't realize is these were private companies.
Yeah.
This wasn't like the city building this.
Right.
So that was a private company, the Southside. What was it called?
Chicago and Southside Rapid Transit Company.
Right. And so all of these various L lines, they all kind of converged on downtown, which wasn't the Loop yet.
Right.
From the northwest and the west, and then the north, I think was the last one, was north, right?
Yeah, the northwestern up north was the
And they were
the
all separate companies.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely.
For decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, basically until CTA took over in 1947.
And when they were first built, were they built, did they have to like buy property to do that? Or was that done, in the alleyways, like the areas that the city already owned?
So you, as a private company building an elevated line in Chicago, you basically had two choices. You could build over the public way, which would be cheaper in the sense of not having to buy property and clear property, and being the very well gridded city that we are, it would give you a very straight, open right of way to build your tracks.
When you say the public way, you mean the street?
The street, or an alley. Although most would chose to do it over a street, just because of the width of the street allowed for more room for the tracks, but a Illinois law passed in 1872 required that for the private use of a public way, you had to get the consent of at least half the property owners along the stretch that you wanted to use. So what that meant
Bribes.
Was exactly pretty much. Industrial, areas and places like that didn't mind, but obviously residential areas and certainly the business community downtown was less amenable to having a steel elevated structure in front of their building. And also recall that in the first years, they were not even electric. They were hauled by small steam locomotives.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you had,
imagine a steam train going past your second story window.
Elevated, right, exactly. Right?
You want a big bribe.
Exactly. All the rumble and that you have today, plus soot and cinders coming down.
So isn't this why the South Side became the Alley L?
Right. So your second choice was to just do it on private property. And in that case, you could go wherever you wanted as long as you could assemble the necessary property. And so the South Side Elevated chose to go that route. it had the nickname the Alley L, but it didn't originally build over the alley. That would have been a public way. It built next to alleys.
Ah.
And they basically bought the rear 30 feet or so of the lots that backed up to the alley. They didn't buy the whole piece of property because private enterprise, you got to keep costs down. You didn't need all that property. They would buy the rear 30 feet or so of the lots, and they ran alongside the alleys, and that gave them the nickname. Later, they actually did extend over the alleyway. They added a third track for express operations, and that was over the alley.
And it was more than a nickname, right? Because I've actually seen pictures where there are signs on the L stations that say the Alley L, like they promoted it, right? As the Alley L.
No, absolutely. I mean, it was a nickname that they embraced and used for themselves for marketing purposes. So, absolutely. I mean, there was painted signage on the elevated structure that referred to it as such. And that's another interesting point, is that it referred to itself as the Alley L, the letter L, in quotes.
I was just going to say that.
It's not E-L.
Right.
It's the letter L. But isn't it a single quote or is it double quotes?
That has been less consistent over the years. My recollection of the photos is that I think it was double quotes, but it has certainly gone back and forth.
So the Alley L that we're talking about is now the Green Line,
right,
on the south side,
right?
Just so that people know, like, which part of the L system we're talking about.
Yeah, it's the what's now the main branch, and then the E63rd branch of today's Green Line.
And there was five different companies that did this. It was the Southside L, the Lake Street L, the Metropolitan West Side L, the Union L, and then Northwestern, right?
Correct. There were actually a sixth company. There were two downtown loop companies, and that was more or less a maneuvering tactic on the part of its builder, or its chief backer, Yerkes. Yeah.
He had two different companies?
Yeah. He in one of his great sort of underhanded schemes to get the loop built. He chartered a second company to build along the Van Buren leg, where he had a lot of opposition.
All right, so now let me just – I've told this story before, but Graham Garfield, you are the definitive expert on this. So I want to find out if I've got this story right. So all these train lines are coming into the loop, but there's no loop. There's no and Yerkes, right. Charles Tyson Yerkes wants to unite them all into this loop, but he doesn't want to like pay bribes.
And this was a ruthless businessman we're talking about.
Yeah.
He was a banker, right?
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah.
And so he just built like one leg at a time, right?
Yes.
And then but he couldn't get the business owners on Van Buren to agree. So tell me if I'm right. He proposed building a line from essentially what would be Wabash all the way to like Halstead.
Right.
But he never intended to build it that far, and he got agreement from those property owners, but then he stopped at Wells.
Correct.
And had a loop.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, essentially I think there was sort of a loophole in the law that, you know, it didn't get into, you know, that it has to be half of the property owners evenly distributed along, you know, the length of it.
Interesting.
It just had to be half of the owners along the length. So he essentially proposed a line that was twice as long as what he intended to build. And in fact, that western half of it, had it been built, would have been about a block or a half a block from an existing line. The Metropolitan
right.
West
exactly.
Side Elevated was already there. But that area was a little bit more industrial in character, and those property owners didn't care. And so he basically got all the property owners on the half he had no intention of building to give consent, and that got him the half that he wanted.
Approximately what year are we talking about?
This would have been about 1896, and it would have been finished construction in 1897.
Well, the World's Columbian Exhibition forced kind of an expansion within even the first year of it being built, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The original section of the first company went from Congress to 39th Street, but before that and that had been planned since the 1880s. I believe the company was chartered in 1888. So the Columbian Exposition hadn't even been planned yet. The Jackson Park hadn't been selected as the World's Fair site yet. So the railroad itself conceptually predated the exposition, but it was announced while they were under construction, and they knew immediately, you know, what kind of an opportunity it was. So they had already announced plans for the extension before the first train even rolled.
Jeffrey, I was going to say, if during the Columbian Exhibition, you know, what was there for transportation? I mean, there were streetcars at the time.
There would have been streetcars.
So we're talking 27 million people coming to Chicago.
Right. Yeah. They had their own internal transportation. They had, like, moving sidewalks. They had – well, was it part of the L system that looped around the site, or was that their own elevated
– it was their own elevated line, the intramural railway, but it was electric at a time when none of the other elevateds in Chicago were electric. And it was actually that demonstration line that convinced the Metropolitan West Side Elevated, which is the third of our L lines to open, to convert. They were going to be a steam line. And then they saw the intramural railway at the Columbian Exposition, and they said,
"We can do
this is the way to go." Yeah.
But to Dave's question, were there streetcar lines running down there from the center of the city and the neighborhoods?
Yeah, there were streetcar lines. They would have been horse car lines and cable car lines.
There were cable cars that far south?
I believe the Cottage Grove line would have gone that far south.
So just so people know, a cable car, this is something people also don't know. a cable car and a trolley are not the same thing. A cable car actually has a moving cable under the ground, and a little arm comes down from the car and grabs onto it like a rope tow on a ski hill and pulls it along. And then they have the cable runs around a giant spool in these things called powerhouses. One of them became Michael Jordan's restaurant on the north side. So that's kind of an elaborate, you know, thing to string that cable.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a very capital intensive system and a lot of maintenance. So they only converted the heaviest used lines from horse cars to cable cars. But Chicago actually had the largest cable car system in the country. It was larger than San Francisco's ever was at its height. But to the issue of getting to the fair, you would have had streetcar lines, and then the Illinois Central ran right by it, so it would have had inner city trains as well as commuter trains, and that was primarily the way people got there. They built a railway station in the fair with the idea of other railroads serving it. It's actually an interesting building unto itself because it's a Louis Sullivan building, and it looked unlike everything else at the fair because he believed that Burnham was looking backwards, not forwards, in his in the choice of the Beaux-Arts for the exposition. So then you had this Louis Sullivan.
Very colorful.
Transportation building.
Right. So you're actually telling me something I've talked about in my TV shows on Channel 11, talked about that transportation building a million times. I didn't know there was a train station in it.
There was also, there was a separate train station that was, I believe, next to it. It was part of a sort of a complex. And the L then went in and it connected to these buildings as well. But I think they convinced one or two railroads to use the station. It just wasn't. I think the railroads just didn't see the value in doing it, so it was a very little used building.
Hmm. And you mentioned Yerkes being one of the big businessmen that actually did this. And by the way, Yerkes, is there an observatory in Lake Geneva?
Yes.
Yerkes
Observatory,
that is him.
University of Chicago.
Yeah, okay, all right. And there were three other guys, though, that were critical historic figures in building of the L.
Well, Samuel Insull, I'm sure, is one you're talking
Insull,
about.
Insull, Crambles, and Bud, I believe, the three, right?
Yeah. I mean, they were all very key figures at different points in the history. Bud and Insull were sort of there together. Yeah, it was Samuel Insull owned Commonwealth Edison, and they came to own the L basically because, you know, the L companies had basically a long history of bankruptcies, repeated bankruptcies. And, you know, it owed in large part to the fact that they were private companies. And they had to raise all the capital, you know, themselves. And, you know, unlike a streetcar line, an elevated system is extremely expensive to build. Before you can ever run the first train, you've outlaid an enormous amount of money, and a lot of them just frankly were never quite able to get over that initial capital outlay and become really profitable. So in essence, though, you know, who is going to be their largest, the largest creditor of an electric railroad?
The power company. Yeah.
So,
ComEd.
Right. Yeah. So in essence, that's how Sam Insull ended up controlling the elevated companies. But he really poured a lot of money and resources into them and other electric railroads, interurban lines around Chicago that he owned as well.
The North Shore line.
North Shore.
And my understanding is that Insull wasn't necessarily so interested in transportation as in development. So, like, for example, running the North Shore line up through the Skokie Valley, you know, he knew that there would be communities that would be built along the route, and of course, they would need electrical power.
Right.
So this was going to open up whole new markets. So, for example, when you drive up the Edens Expressway, and you look to your left, if you're driving north, you've seen all those electrical lines, you know, over what is now a freight line and a bike path. But mm-hmm. that was the old North Shore line, and those Samuel Insull ran all those electric lines up through there for communities like Northfield, you know, Northbrook, yeah. Deerfield, you know. They're all
– so he was thinking way ahead of his time, obviously. Yeah.
He was. I mean, you know, I think that I think he did believe in the value of the railroads, but he was definitely, you know, he was playing a long game. I mean, he saw the sort of, you know, what in current business terms we would just, you know, call the synergistic value of having all of these things bundled together.
Until the Great Depression.
And, you
he
know,
really got sunk.
He did, and he had, you know, plans for developments along L lines that never came to fruition as a result, or were long delayed until after
In Westchester, I know about one, right?
In Westchester.
What was that called? Canterbury?
It was Canterbury, yeah.
Yeah, there was a Canterbury train station in Westchester, and there's a prairie out there called Wolf Road Prairie that has sidewalks running through it because it got laid out as a town that was going to be developed, and then it never got developed, and it got reclaimed as prairie. And I believe the Canterbury station would have been their stop, right?
Yeah, right around
there.
And
then 294 kind of ran through there and now you sliced it off.
You were talking about that when the CTA took it over, was it the 1940s? When was it?
Yeah.
But in 1911, there was a trust that brought kind of the companies together, even though they were all individually run.
Yeah, I mean, they...
What was the purpose?
Basically, coordination and cutting costs. I mean, they saw very early on that there was value in working together. And for the most part, you know, even though the L companies were private companies and technically competitors, with the exception of the two West Side lines, they really weren't serving the same territories as one another. Their prime competitors were the streetcar companies, not so much each other. And so, you know, as time went on, you already, by the turn of the century, you started to already get sort of cross-pollination in the ownership or administration of the companies. Yerkes not only owned the loop, he chartered the Northwestern Elevated, and he bought the Lake Street Elevated. So by the turn of the century, he already controlled three of the five main L companies.
When you say the Northwestern Elevated, that's now the Red Line and the Brown Line, right?
Correct, yes, yeah. So, I mean, there was already, you know, common ownership of some companies, and they would have the same company officers controlling both companies. And so I think by, you know, the teens, they simply saw the value of working together, but rather than merging, they created this sort of voluntary association, essentially a holding company.
What was it called?
The Chicago Elevated Railways Collateral Trust.
CER.
Very nice. Catchy name. Nice. Catchy name. But they're commonly just the Chicago Elevated Railways. Their logo is actually a roundel that looks not unlike the London Underground logo. And so that sort of brought them together in a voluntary way, but didn't dissolve the underlying companies. And that lasted about another 12 or 13 years until the mid 20s, and then they finally merged into one.
And what
company
was that called?
Chicago Rapid Transit Company.
And that was one company?
That was one company.
And what's the Chicago Surface Lines? So, I hear that name.
The Surface Lines were basically the streetcar companies, but they were the Surface Lines was more like the Elevated Railways, the holding company. It wasn't one company. The streetcar companies never did dissolve the underlying companies. They kept them intact, and the Surface Lines was a basically sort of a holding company. But it had a much better sort of centralized identity, whereas the Chicago Elevated Railways Trust, it was that 12 or 13 year period was very inconsistent in terms of what we would now call branding. It didn't, you know, they didn't necessarily identify it as that back then, but advertisements and printed material would be very inconsistent. Sometimes they would use the Chicago Elevated Railways name. Sometimes they would use the underlying company name. They didn't do a good job of sort of presenting one corporate image, whereas the CSL was very consistent.
Yeah,
it was,
you see
everything
that advertising
was CSL
all the time, right?
Yeah. But yeah, those underlying companies actually still existed, the streetcar company.
So, Graham, you were talking about the fact that the L system, you know, went through several bankruptcies over time. It was never really that profitable. And in the early 1940s, they decided it's time to turn it over to a municipal kind of operation.
Yeah, there had been several attempts or movements before that to potentially have the government take it over, what was referred to at the time as municipal ownership. It never really quite got off the ground. But yeah, by the time the 40s rolled around, that had begun to change. The general feeling about government running transit had changed. It was a very different, I think, cultural feeling about the idea of government running something like that back then. There was a lot, you know, this is before, you know, the New Deal, before, you know, there was much more government involvement in everyday life that we sort of take for granted today. You know, there was less of that back then. And there was also, I think, a feeling very much left over, not necessarily accurate, that you know, railroads were a strong, profitable industry. And, you know, really, in a lot of ways, that was a sort of, I think, a leftover myth to some degree from, you know, the boom times of the 1800s. And certainly in the 20th century, there were times when railroads were very, very strong. But transit was never in the same league as, you know, the big railroads. But I think there was a little bit of that feeling as well, that, you know, you don't need to, government doesn't need to mess with them. They can make it on their own, kind of a thing.
So, but did this become kind of like a bailout for the private companies that were sinking?
That's what it seems like to me, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you could look at it that way, I suppose. I mean, the idea that
it's not working, let's give it to the government to run it, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, and there's sort of an interesting, you know, aspect to that where there were certainly certain things that when the government took it over did put the L companies, or, you know, what had been the L companies and the streetcar companies, in a little bit better position to survive, because they were, although they were private companies, they were viewed very much as utilities and they were heavily regulated. And part of that was regulating the fare. They could not freely set their own fare. Mm. For most of the companies, the fare was established in their charter, the ordinance from the city that allowed them to operate. And that had been a nickel originally, and it was a nickel for a long time, and it became sort of a sacred cow. But eventually, especially after World War I, you know, with inflation, the buying power wasn't there for that amount of money.
I think they should go back to a nickel. They get a lot more riders.
We would. Yeah, well, that's true. Certainly our ridership numbers would go up. But and they ended up having to go to court.
Maybe that's a good idea for June 6th on the anniversary, see a nickel fair.
Maybe.
Hey, that'd be a great idea.
Yeah. But it has to be a Buffalo nickel. If you can get us a historic nickel, you get to ride.
Nice.
Okay. All right.
How about a token? I've got a little collection of tokens.
That's cool.
Right when they were, you know, the CTA eliminated tokens. You would know, Graham, around when?
1999.
So I probably, like many people, I ran out and got a roll of tokens.
Yeah.
Like, okay, these are going away.
Yeah.
They're
save those.
Stuck in a drawer somewhere. Yeah. I don't know where they are.
Yep.
So they essentially took over. The CTA is 70 years old. They took over the L, but they also took over the streetcars as well.
Right. So they took over both companies. And so, you know, there were some advantages. The CTA could set their own fares, and they immediately raised fares. They did. It needed to be done, and they had the freedom to do so. And then bringing the streetcar company and the L company together allowed them to really unify the system. There was a great deal of duplication in services because they had been competitors. It allowed them to really reform the system as one unified whole rather than as a very duplicative set of routes. It allowed them to close L stations, which, you know, sounds bad, but, you know, there were L stations very, very close together, in areas that were maybe better served by streetcars, or, you know, they could route streetcars to feed L stations. I mean, just all of that sort of overhaul needed to happen. And by giving them together to one entity to run, they were able to do that.
I could put you totally on the spot, but this is the kind of question that Graham Garfield can answer. Like, at its height, approximately, how many L stations were there and how many are there today?
There's 145 today. And my recollection, because I ran the numbers at one point.
227.
Is it 227?
Oh, Dave's got it.
I've got it right here.
Okay.
Yeah, which is massive. That's a lot of, you know.
Yeah.
Did you get that from ChicagoL.org?
Oh, of course I did. Of course I did.
See, I can't even remember the entire contents of my own site.
Honestly, if you have not looked at this website, this is Jeffrey from WTTW. I mean, I use your website all the time. I was mentioning earlier, I've seen pictures of the sign say L.E.L. I'm sure I saw that on...
That's where I saw it, too. It's Chicago-L.org, and you got to check
this
out.
Like, it's unbelievable the amount of... I don't know when you sleep.
But it's 20 years in the making.
I dream of the L.
I bet you do. 50s, 60s, 70s came around. The expressways helped really expand the system as well.
Yeah, the expressways were sort of an interesting double-edged sword for the CTA in that, you know, obviously they were a contributor to the shifting population demographics and you know, flight out to the suburbs. But they also provided an opportunity to build new lines. And Chicago was really a pioneer in this concept of putting a rapid transit line in the median of an expressway. There had been some somewhat similar precedents beforehand, but not really quite like we know them today. And it, you know, the idea was to have a sort of dense corridor of transportation where you could have fast cars and fast trains, and you know, people would come to sort of these trunks, you know, these like transportation arteries. And, you know, in terms of money, it was very cost efficient to do it that way because there was a great deal of money available, particularly after the Interstate Highway Act, to just clear, you know, the paths for interstates. And, you know, there's a whole discussion that can be had, of course, about the ups and downs of that policy. But be that as it may, the money was there. And it essentially could clear an alignment to build a rapid transit line. So while the rapid transit wouldn't be paid for by the interstate funds, it would basically prepare this ready-made, very straight, very, you know, high-speed alignment that they could then just drop the tracks into.
And so, right, so people of my age, I remember the interstate highways being built. And then the L... Not on the Eisenhower, because that was sort of right from the get-go. But
right.
the L kind of came. I remember when they built it out to O'Hare on the Kennedy.
Yep.
But it's important to know that wasn't an afterthought. That median was built wide enough to someday accommodate a train. Like, they knew from the time they were building
right.
the expressway that someday there would be a train line.
Yeah, no, yeah, absolutely. They planned it that way from day one, and based on, as you mentioned, the Eisenhower, which has the Forest Park branch of the Blue Line, opened as the Congress Line, was a precursor to that, because that highway was built pre-interstate program. But I think they immediately saw the value, and so when Chicago began planning the rest of its interstates, they planned the medians wide enough for these lines. And so there's actually interstates that have medians wide enough for L lines but do not have L lines in them.
Which ones? Wow.
So the Stevenson has a wide median out to about the city limits, somewhere around Central or so, has a median wide enough for transit. The original plan was actually for a busway rather than a train line. And there's actually renderings of that from the 50s showing what would today we would call BRT.
Bus Rapid Transit.
Okay. Yeah.
These are buses that operate on their own dedicated right-of-ways and have stations like train stations, but they're buses.
Gotcha.
Right.
Gotcha.
But there's actually also a little part of the Kennedy that was built to accommodate an L line and never got one, basically because the path that the extension to Jefferson Park and then later to O'Hare took was not the original alignment.
Ah.
It was originally going to split off the line to Logan Square a little before Logan Square and go up something around Talman or one of those streets and then go into the Kennedy. So, for instance, where the Kennedy crosses California, there is a very wide gap between the express lanes and the, I think it's the northbound lanes, and that's basically where the L would have gone. The way that those that overpass looks is identical to how the overpasses at Irving Park and Pulaski look that have an L station in them. So there's basically big gaps between the expressway where there's...
Well, one of the things you're talking about is something I love, which I call them sort of ghost infrastructure. Which is so wonderful. There's a place where the Blue Line goes underground kind of in like Wicker Park, or I guess comes up from underground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you can still see like where... Like ads used to be on the sides of buildings up at the second level because it used to be an L structure.
Yeah.
But now it's dips down underground and or even in the loop where the Metropolitan West Side Elevated or was it the Chicago Aurora and Elgin used to come in at a 90 degree angle to to the loop structure on the
right.
West side of the loop. There's like a gap between some buildings and ghost billboards up in the air where you can't really see them from the street because there used to be a whole train platform up there.
Absolutely.
It's approximately where on the west side of the loop?
It's like between Jackson and Van Buren.
Going like essentially as almost like a T intersection going west from the Brown Line or from the elevator
from
structure.
The L structure, yeah.
Now, did you notice this when you did your Chicago by L tour that you were when you were exploring through the city?
Oh, you know, It really just over the years, I've just kind of you run across these little sort of bits of ghost infrastructure, and I just always find them really fascinating.
Yeah, oh, me too. I mean, as you know, I've always growing up loved cities and studying urban planning in college. That stuff, and then the history aspect of it weaved in. I always find those things absolutely fascinating because it's you know there's two kinds. There's the there was something here, and now it's gone, but there's some sort of remnant.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the,
we were going to build it,
but we didn't. There's some indication
of that. It seemed like a good idea at the time.
Right. And one of those, it's not L-related, but that I've never found the answer to, is the off-ramps from Lakeshore Drive to Navy Pier. There's the ramp splits. Yeah.
And it goes nowhere.
I have no idea where that was going to go. Yeah. Somewhere there's plans that answer that. But
you know, you know the lines that you take for transportation every day. I think you're special, and I know this, and it was back in the early 2000s, is what kind of introduced me to all the other lines and all the fascinating things along the way. And that's what I find your tours just amazing. I always learn something. I was saying to Graham earlier that it's one of those things where, like, if you stop and you're watching Goodfellas and you see it on cable, you'll stop and watch a little bit of that. You'll watch a little bit. It's how I feel about your tours. No matter where we are in them, I will just stop and I will watch it to the end because I always learn something.
Thank you very much.
I was saying the same thing, and no matter how many times I've seen it, it's always it's either just entertaining, just enjoyable, even if you remember the information. But often there's so much information packed into each one that there's no way you retain it.
No.
So it's
I gotta watch it again.
It's like you learn something new every time, even if you've seen it before. They're really fantastic.
Thank you. Well, I just learn a lot doing them.
I bet.
I generally think, well, you know, I never knew that, and I bet Channel 11 viewers probably don't know that either, or most of them.
Well, that's why I like the Ask Jeffrey segments, because that helps fulfill some other, you know, needs for education in between watching some of the tours. And you mentioned some of the signs are just as legendary, and some of the logos from some of the companies. And you answered a question. I remember watching this, that there's a lot of misspellings also in a lot of the L lines and so forth. Street names being misspelled.
On the L line specifically?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You had mentioned, I can't remember.
Well,
I
got to tell you, sometimes I don't even remember some of these segments that we've done. I have to ask my brilliant producer, Erica Gunderson. But the misspelling that I do remember is what you alluded to earlier, which is how people spell the L.
The L. And the quotes,
which is letter L.
Yeah.
And it really irks me because I occasionally see in the New York Times Sunday crossword, you know, it'll say Chicago trains, and the answer will be ELSLs.
Oh, gosh.
Because, you know, you have to have a three-letter answer in the New York Times crossword. You can't have a two-letter answer. But I always want to call up Will Shorts and say, no, it's L, letter L.
Exactly. And we're seeing a lot of these L stations starting to get some remodeling done in them. I'm seeing a lot of bright blue on the Kennedy being repainted and resigned. So there's a lot of projects happening as we speak.
Yeah, there's a lot of capital investment that's happening on the system, and it's really fantastic because it L ridership is up. It's very strong. It's some of the strongest we've seen in decades, and for better or worse. Some of it is starting to be outstripped, capacity-wise. And in addition, some of it is, the infrastructure is just aging. A lot of it dates from before the Americans with Disabilities Act, so the accessibility isn't there. But the demand is there. And so, we really want to, keep it viable for the next 100 years, and to do that, it requires some investment. But we've luckily had some great support from the federal level down to the local level, and Mayor Emanuel has been very supportive of transit. So we've seen some really good investment programs in the past, and there's still more coming up.
You know, my kids early on in their education went to Montessori school. And when they took their field trips, they were required to take public transportation. They did as a kid, since third or fourth grade. So they would go buy their pass or ticket, whatever it was, and they would have to map out and find their way around. And in this day and age of Google Maps and everything else, you don't know how to get anywhere now without your phone.
Right.
Yeah.
And this, this allowed, my son started working at Wrigley Field. He's 16, and he does not have, he just got a car, but I'm not going to have him drive it down and pay for parking. He's got to figure out his way from Edison Park to Wrigley Field every day, and he knows how to map it out. He knows he's got to take an hour and 45 minutes in advance to do it, but he knows what L, the Metra, and everything else to get him to Wrigley to work on time. And I think that's pretty critical, is to teach your kids about public trans.
Yeah.
Oh, for sustainability, just if we're going to survive as a species, we got to get out of our cars, one of the it's a chicken and egg thing, because obviously we have the legacy of an L system that's very downtown centric. Everything takes you downtown. I know there's been talk over the years of this yellow, right? The circle line, not the yellow line, the circle line, just ways to connect the outlying lines so that you can transfer. You'd have to transfer a couple times, but you don't have to go all the way into downtown to just go all the way out again. But that's probably, the next big challenge.
Yeah. I mean, it is a challenge because, that's one of the difficult things about a system like the L is, with all of that fixed infrastructure, it's not flexible. It's very slow to change, to make major changes like route extensions or shifting lines. And that's, that's a major challenge. I mean, and you know, as Jeffrey mentioned, you know, there's been talk of non-CBD based lines.
Right?
Yeah. You know, the Circle Line is the most recent, and for on and off for a few decades, there's been discussion of something called the Mid-City Transit Way, which is further out. And basically, it's kind of the old crosstown, you know, expressway
route. And that's a bus rapid transit along Ashland or Western, right? Well,
then there's that, which is more recent and I think is a much more...
viable,
economical and viable, you know, way to do it, at least in the short term, you know, to do it with enhanced bus service in a way that more closely mimics rail-based rapid transit. And, you know, then if that gets a high enough ridership and constituency, then you can kind of say, well, okay, maybe we now need to look at that bigger investment for rail.
And now you have a celebration coming up in June, still working out the details, but you could be throwing some of the classic cars on the line to ride. There's only one wooden one you said left, though, and
right.
That's at the History Museum.
Yes, our last wooden car, which was Southside car number one, the CTA gave to the History Museum, it was about 10 or 12.
Oh, it's
ago.
Great. It's
the highlight.
It's on display.
Yeah.
Fully restored.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
It's being enjoyed a great deal. I think we're going to need to replace the rattan seat covering soon.
No. Yeah.
But you've got that Heritage Fleet. I've ridden on what was the car I saw you on back in the Open House Chicago?
It was our 1920s vintage 4000 series cars.
Wow. And there's two of them.
There's two of them.
They're painted brown.
They're painted brown and orange, which were the colors that they wore in the 1940s. They were the CRT, Chicago Rapid Transit Company colors.
And that so still runs.
That's amazing to me.
They still
run.
Amazing.
And if you want to see some of these series and look at some of the pictures and so forth, again, Graham's website is chicago-l.org. It's amazing information. And then we'll look to the CTA to see what's coming up in June.
Yeah, in June, it'll be the 125th anniversary of the first L service there on the south side. And we definitely plan to have some great celebrations for that as part of sort of a whole year-long 70th anniversary of the CTA itself. But for that 125th is sort of going to be our first big event in a series of events this year. We're still finalizing the details, but we're definitely going to look to provide some opportunities for the public to enjoy our heritage fleet. We'll probably have some nice commemorative materials, and we're going to definitely have a good event that day on June 6th.
And Buffalo nickels.
And fairs will be a nickel.
Fair will be a authentic Buffalo nickel.
I like that.
Our chief financial officer, I'm sure, will enjoy my
really
the promise that I've
promise.
Made here. Yes.
Jeffrey, what do you got working on that you're working on these days?
Oh, gosh. Well, I was in Cuba for 3 weeks, and we've got a film called Weekend in Havana.
Wow.
That where three locals show me around Havana, Cuba, which will be debuting nationwide on PBS on July 18th.
Cool.
And then I'll be out on the river all summer filming a new Chicago River Tour for WTTW Channel 11. We did the first one in 95. We had to remake it in 2005 because everything changed. Everything's changed again with the Riverwalk and all that. So we're doing this film, which is going to be on in November. And I'm about to also hit the road and start traveling for the second season of 10 That Changed America.
Oh, cool. Yeah, love that.
Our national PBS primetime series. So it's three shows, 10 monuments that changed America, like the St. Louis Arch and the Vietnam Veterans Memorial and Statue of Liberty. I'm going to be at Mount Rushmore in a couple of weeks. 10 streets that changed America, like the Lincoln Highway, First Coast to Coast Highway, Broadway in New York, things like that. And 10 modern marvels that changed America, like Hoover Dam and the Erie Canal.
It's awesome. Looking forward to that.
That'll be on
always.
2018 on PBS.
And of course, all the tours available at WTTW.com. Jeffrey Barry, Graham Garfield, thank you both for joining us and sharing the rich history of the L. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, it was fun.
My pleasure.
All right. My thanks to you both.